This is the Afternoon Magazine. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks so much for tuning in today. The fastest growing alternative to skilled nursing care for frail older Americans is assisted living. These residences attempt to offer a place to live that's more like home. On the program today, we'll take a look at assisted living with two of the authors of Inside Assisted Living, The Search for Home. Our guests are J. Kevin Eckert and Anne Christine Frankowski. Kevin Eckert is the dean of the Erickson School of Aging Studies at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County, where he is also a professor in the Department of Sociology and Anthropology. Anne Christine Frankowski is a senior research associate with the Center for Aging Studies at the Erickson School and an adjunct assistant professor of Sociology and Anthropology at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. Eckert and Frankowski are two of five authors who collaborated on a five-year study of six types of assisted living residents. For this study, they interviewed more than 350 people, including people living, visiting, and working in assisted living settings. Listeners, I invite your questions and comments this afternoon for our guests. You can join us with a telephone call. If you're listening in the Champaign-Urbana area, the number is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number. That number is 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Inside Assisted Living, The Search for Home is available in paperback from the Johns Hopkins Press. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, toll-free 800-222-9455. Kevin Eckert and Christine Frankowski, welcome. Thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
At the outset here, I think we need to talk about a couple of questions that are very obvious. What is assisted living and how does it differ from skilled nursing care?
Well, let me try and answer that. Assisted living, by definition, is a non-medical setting that is very different from a nursing home in that it's not regulated in the same way that nursing homes are regulated. Nursing homes can accept public dollars from Medicaid, for example, and are highly regulated. In fact, one of the most heavily regulated types of settings in this country. Assisted living are regulated in most states, but under very different laws and to a much lesser extent. As in contrast to the nursing home, which is a medical care environment, the assisted living is really a more social, home-like environment. And in many states, a philosophy has been adopted, which is known as the social model of care, which really tries to do all it can to respect resident autonomy and privacy and create an environment as home-like as possible.
Yeah. Now, the facilities that you studied for your work that you've written about here in Inside Assisted Living, they're very different.
Yes.
Is that typical out of what's available out across the country?
You know, it is. Assisted living, one of the dilemmas with assisted living is it incorporates a lot, many different kinds of housing types, both small and large. For example, in Maryland, homes that were once single-family dwellings have been converted into assisted living residences that might house 6 to 8 to 10 residents, as well as there are large commercial chains that house well over 100 people, and all of those settings are labeled assisted living. In Illinois, for example, it's somewhat similar that I would imagine in Illinois you have both new purpose-built places as well as smaller converted homes that all come under the assisted living regulations in Illinois.
And Anne Christine, a question for you here. The move out of one's home and into assisted living, or a nursing home for that matter, often comes in the midst of a crisis. Now, given the variety of facilities that are out there, how much time are people able to put into the search for a facility?
Most of the time, very little time. Individuals don't really plan for this kind of eventuality. And very often, an individual will go into a hospital, and then the medical staff will say this individual can no longer live alone, and it's left up to a family member, perhaps a friend. I've seen neighbors, powers of attorney, who have to go out and find something for the individual in a very short period of time. A lot of hospitals release individuals maybe with 2 or 3 days' notice, sometimes even 24 hours' notice. So it's a really difficult decision for people to have to make very often, very quickly.
And how do people get information about assisted living facilities?
Well, if they're in the hospital, there are booklets with listings of sites. But basically, right now, people go on the computer and find sites under those listings. But before that, it was really difficult, looking around, walking around, trying to find a spot to place a resident. A lot of places are filled up very quickly. Other places have, other openings. But there's also so many choices out there that, people who have to respond quickly are in a real quandary. One of the families that we talk about in the book, Dr. Catherine, her daughter was very planful in this regard, even mm-hmm. though she could not get her mom on board to select something. So when the crisis occurred in that instance, she knew of places and knew where to turn. And she was very fortunate that way.
I'd like to add that there really is a challenge for the consumer when it comes to selecting assisted living. And as Anne said, there are many different types of housing types, service packages, social amenities, costs, all of which vary site to site. So it really is incumbent on the consumer to find out all they can. And often, what's on the web, for example, describing a place may not be necessarily what you find when you go there. So we encourage people to definitely visit any place they're interested in moving into or having a loved one move into.
Yeah. What questions would you ask on your own behalf or that of a loved one if you were searching for an assisted living facility?
Why don't I start and then Anne can fill in here. But there are a couple questions that you have to address right off the bat, and that is sort of the size of the place and what your expectations are. For example, some people know right away they want to be in a smaller setting, much more like a home, like where they may have moved from. Other people are much more comfortable with a larger kind of place with many more services and amenities available. So, and of course, you have to weigh costs. So, you want to get a sense of the place, how it looks, and most specifically, you want to get a sense of how it feels. You want to be there. You want to watch how staff interact with residents. You want to watch how residents interact with each other. I would suggest that people visit a setting at mealtime. When people come together, that's a typical time of day when people come together at lunch or for dinner, and watch what goes on. I think a little observation is really, really important, not just visiting, talking to an intake person or reading the brochures, but actually spending some hours watching what goes on in the setting before making a decision.
Hmm. And I would also suggest going more than once.
More than once, yes.
Because, different things happen over different afternoons with different residents and different staff members.
And weekends, going on the weekends.
And certainly on the evenings as well.
Evenings and weekends.
And different people, require different things. Some people are very interested in activities, and so there are some activities that are offered in some places more so than others. Other individuals want a quiet setting. They don't want to be on the busy street. Other individuals want public transportation, so they want to be on a bus line, because some people who reside in assisted living are independent enough to leave the home and to go shopping on their own. So individuals have to sit down and think, beside cost and beside what kind of medical management is necessary, what are an individual's, maybe top three priorities in their life over the next couple of years?
Mm-hmm. Right. Also along those lines, as you're in a place, I think it's important to to watch how the residents interact. For example, in some settings, there are multiple levels of care where there's independent living, assisted living, and then there might be a special unit for people with dementia. In other settings, people are share the setting, those who have some dementia, those who do not. So in some small homes, the home may serve only people with dementia. So it's important to understand that and try and select a setting that you think fits best with your requirements.
Yeah. What is the range of cost?
You know, it varies widely across the country, but you know, we have seen small settings that on the East Coast here charge as little as $1,500 a month, and then there are settings, some of the purpose-built places with amenities and elaborate physical structures that can be in the neighborhood of $6,000 a month. So there's tremendous variability.
Yeah. So, like in the case of a couple of places that you looked at and were involved with, Valley Glen is a very different place than the Chesapeake.
Very different. And as I recall, Valley Glen, was that about $2,500 per month?
Yeah, I think so.
And it varies. At a place like Valley Glen, there may be variation in the fee based on the individual. Whereas in some other places, there may be a fixed fee schedule that's a la carte or just fixed fees. And also we've noticed across settings, especially in this economic downturn, we've seen any number of places vary their fee structure based on occupancy rate. In other words, we've also seen people, so if you're down in occupancy, the rate may actually be less to retain people or to attract people. Mm. Or in cases where individuals are running out of money, they may move to a less expensive room. So many, many places are doing all they can to retain residents.
Go ahead.
Another thing to think about is there may be a monthly fee of $3,500, but the consumer also has to ask, is there an additional charge for medication management?
Yes.
Is there additional charge for laundry? Is there an additional charge for lunch, which is brought to the room, if you don't feel like going to the dining room? Mm-hmm. And so you have to look at a whole series of these charges. Another thing which comes into play, which many people don't realize, is that a lot of the assisted living homes have what's called a community fee, which means that at the end of 3 months, if you decide that you're going to stay and take a full year's contract, then you pay an additional fee of $2,500. That's be a general fee, which then goes to the, you know, really upkeep of the assisted living. It does not support any of the private care that you would get as a resident there.
What happens to someone who outlives their assets and they're in assisted living?
Well, this is a real dilemma. This is a real dilemma. Assisted living is by and large private pay. And in some states, and Illinois is one of those states, there are waiver programs, 1915C waiver programs, that allow dollars to be diverted from nursing homes to support some number of slots or some number of people in assisted living. But there are very few of those typically available in most states. So, for example, if a person spends down, they may or may not qualify, or there may or may not be state money available to allow them to use Medicaid dollars to stay in their assisted living. They may need to move to a nursing home, for example.
Mm.
In other situations where assisted living do not accept Medicaid dollars, some we've seen in any number of places, they have their own in-house funds available to support people who are spending down, where there might be a charitable fund that they use to support people who run out of money, or they will move them to a smaller room. They'll work with the family to try and allow that person to stay there. And then, of course, it also happens that when people run out of money, they're asked to leave.
Yeah. Tell us about Karen, who lived in a facility called Huntington Inn.
Yes.
And the owner was a Mr. Hill.
Yes. Anne?
What's interesting about this particular assisted living is that Mr. Hill was very involved in the political aspects of running a home, which you don't find in every place. He knew the ins and outs of trying to keep Karen at Huntington Inn, and he worked for her benefit in terms of the numbers of illnesses that he had. That she had. One of the things that's interesting about what he was able to do was knowing the system and knowing that she had spent down tremendous number of her funds and that there were no longer any Medicaid waivers available in the state at the time, he knew the system well enough that if she was to return to a nursing home, then she could she would have the month, four or five weeks, where she could re-enter the assisted living, and was able to do so.
Mr. Hill was a real coach and advocate for many residents and their families.
Yeah, that was good to read. Also, I'm trying to think of the woman who Ronnie. People who really care about those that they are caring for.
Absolutely, mm-hmm. Absolutely. It's quite extraordinary. Ronnie had her mother living with her. She had a psychology degree. She was from another country. She had a graduate degree in psychology and wasn't able to get licensed here and to make a living, converted their home into a small assisted living setting community. And she had six people there at the time we did our work, all of whom had dementia for the most part, and just provided extraordinary care, cooked the food that each person wanted. It's truly remarkable setting.
What's also remarkable that we found across all of our six settings is that the staff have a real commitment to the residents. If the staff are going to stay in the place, in the homes, and if they're going to continue the work and not leave soon after they take the employment position, then we have found a great source of commitment, understanding, companionship,
empathy for
so many of the residents that live there, and that I think is was really remarkable. I mean, the staff are not well paid positions, and yet they do a remarkable job on their own time. They will visit residents in the nursing home if they happen to be there temporarily, if they've moved to another assisted living. They will come after hours to help a resident, especially one that's maybe not feeling particularly well on a particular day, even if she's, if she's depressed. They will, what I call, prop up residents who need a bit, put on an extra bit of makeup, some jewelry, make them feel good about themselves and go that extra mile. And I found it overwhelmingly, no matter whether it was at a small home like at Ronnie's or at the Chesapeake, the staff really came up to the front on that.
I just, now that you mentioned the Huntington Inn, I just wanted to add there, Mr. Hill, is an example of how important leadership is in these settings, the management, if you will. What happened at Huntington Inn is that during our work there, over the course of the years we were there, several years we were there, Mr. Hill died suddenly of a heart attack, and a new administrator took over who really approached managing the place in a very different way from Mr. Hill, much more bureaucratic, much more like a nursing home. And during that period of months that this new administrator was there, residents left. Residents were very dissatisfied. Staff left. The home was really changing dramatically. And in fact, the Mr. Hill's wife, who was the owner, saw this and fired this particular administrator and brought in a new person who reinstituted Mr. Hill's leadership style and brought the home back. So that is to illustrate how important the leadership is, how dynamic these settings are over time.
And how did you select these particular facilities?
We specifically specifically wanted a range of settings in Maryland. And Maryland, you know, as a state, you know, is very similar to many other states in how it approaches assisted living. We wanted a range of settings. We wanted small. We wanted larger settings. We wanted settings that were part of large chains, settings that were more independent, settings that were owner-operated, settings that were in a suburban location close to the city or more rural locations. So we selected all the available sites that met those criteria and then purposefully selected this constellation of places, all in the Baltimore, Washington area.
Yeah. As I mentioned earlier, your study lasted 5 years.
Yes. Uh-huh.
How much change in these facilities did you see over that period of time?
A lot of change.
Yeah.
And I think that's one of the key findings of our work, is that what you have here is a situation where you have individuals whose status is changing, and you have settings who are changing. Ownership changes, management changes, staff changes, the economy changes. There are multiple things occurring simultaneously that continually influence the fit between the resident and the place. So it's truly a moving target, which again makes it complicated for families.
Yeah.
But most of these settings do their very best to provide the best care they can provide in the most stable setting they can provide, even though there are all these changes taking place all the time.
How long do residents stay?
It's about an average of 2.5 to 3 years on average in assisted living.
Right, but we found many people who had lived in the assisted living for 11 years,
yes.
13 years, 8 years.
Right, long time.
Yeah, so
long
I mean, some people will leave at the end of 1 or 2 months, or they'll die after a couple of months, and so there's really a large range.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I would think stability is important to people, no matter where they are, in terms of being a resident, being a family member of a resident, being staff.
It is. It absolutely is. And as I said, settings and the management leadership and settings do all they can to remain as stable as possible. So even if the ownership of a place changes, let's say a company is a set of assisted living is bought up by a new chain of assisted living, they will do all they can to not have a huge turnover. But it's a real task to maintain stability with so many variables changing all the time, and of course your residence mix changes.
Mm-hmm.
One of the real issues in assisted living right now is that the acuity of residents is increasing dramatically over time. Not only are they aging in place and developing more physical and cognitive problems, but the actual kinds of people that are moving into assisted living are often sicker. So, you know, you have a real mix and a real change in the resident mix in many places.
And many of the long-term residents have told us that they've observed this as new residents are coming in, that they're coming in much more frail and much less cognitively alert.
Mm-hmm.
And whereas in the past they could have, you know, they had bridge clubs and did all sorts of outings, plays, and theaters, et cetera. They're no longer able to do that with the residents that are moving in now.
And is that a matter of economics?
You know, it's hard to know. It's really hard to know. People, of course, are living longer. There are more of us. It's hard to know. I will say that the nursing home, the number of people residing in nursing homes is about, I just read today, 1.5 million. It's gone down. It was 1.6. So it's stayed stable. So nursing homes aren't going away. The number of people living in assisted living nationally is about 1 million. I think that what's happening is families who are the backbone of care for older people in need and always have been are tending to do more, especially in more difficult economic times. You know, they're choosing to stay at home, choosing to do all they can to keep a person at home and to care for them.
Hmm.
One of the things that we found at Laurel Ridge, which was interesting, is there was the director of nursing found almost a cyclical program where a resident who was taken care of by family members who were extremely busy was becoming extremely more frail, so that resident would move into Laurel Ridge, get better, medications would be given regularly, eat well, in 3 or 4 months go back home to save money, stay home for a couple of months, again, because the family was extremely busy, didn't attend to the resident. The resident got more frail, moved back to Laurel Ridge. And so there's all sorts of ways of, you know, of trying to get care in the assisted living and also mediating family needs.
Yeah. I want to go back to the idea of outliving your assets and ask the question, it seems to me that nursing home care, skilled care, is a lot more expensive than assisted living.
Yes, it is.
But now we've got sicker people in assisted living.
Right.
That's one issue. Then we've got the issue of when it comes time for people who have outlived their money. They're going to go on Medicaid, and they're likely to end up, if this is correct, this is my understanding, in a nursing home setting. In terms of policy, what are the states thinking? What's the government thinking about what's the future?
Right. Well, that's just an excellent question. I mean, how you described it, it doesn't make much sense, does it? It's not a very rational system where we don't fund options that are less expensive and could provide appropriate and adequate services, and we go for the more expensive option. And I think that's what, for example, the 915 waiver program is all about, which allows people to stay in assisted living and receive care that would qualify them to a nursing home. But the problem there is that there's not enough money to go around. In other words, it's limited by money, that states don't have the resources to provide enough slots to take full advantage of that particular opportunity. Clearly, finding ways to get more public dollars to home and community-based services to support families in caring for loved ones, to provide lower-cost options that provide the most flexibility and independence, I think in terms of national policy is the way to go. Of course, the dilemma is how to fund it. Now, there's a particular piece of legislation that's been around quite a while. It's called the Community Living Assistance Service Supports Plan that was developed by Senator Ted Kennedy that would create a national voluntary long-term care insurance program, which would make a lot of sense, where individuals would contribute monthly premiums through their employment, and essentially they would have a public long-term care insurance program that would support them some of their long-term care needs when they need them in the future. That would be a public system that you could wrap long-term care insurance around. That's being discussed. I understand there may even be bipartisan support for the CLASS plan. But that, to me, is a wonderful way to empower people to put money away that they could then use in the future to cover these sorts of needs. Because as it stands right now, there really is no way to fund assisted living on a large scale outside of your own resources, which means there are very few. It's not affordable for lower and middle-class people for the most part. And that, to me, I think, is the real dilemma is, you know, if you have resources, you have choices. If you don't have resources, you do not have choice, unless we find a way to develop some sort of public plan like this that would really empower people.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. This afternoon, we're taking a look at assisted living with two of the authors of Inside Assisted Living, The Search for Home. Our guests are J. Kevin Eckert and Anne Christine Frankowski. Kevin Eckert is the dean of the Erickson School of Aging Studies at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County, where he is also a professor in the Department of Sociology and Anthropology. Anne Christine Frankowski is a senior research associate with the Center for Aging Studies at the Erickson School and an adjunct assistant professor of sociology and anthropology at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon with questions, comments. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number. That number is 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. I would like to talk a little bit about the first home that's profiled in the book and the resident who you call Miss Helen. And this is the home, Valley Glen Home, that is run by Ronnie, or was at the time. Miss Helen, when you became acquainted with her, was unable to assist with any of the activities of daily living. She was unable to move on her own. Now, this to me was surprising. Was there any question at any time, and as time went on, whether she should be moved to a skilled care facility? When she entered Valley Glen, she was mobile, but her condition deteriorated over time. How was she able to remain at Valley Glen?
Ronnie was committed to the residents that she felt that she could more than adequately care for. And she had a staff. She had other people that helped her, you know, a staff plus her son. And she felt that Miss Helen was able to live quite comfortably and quite well under her care. I think she was what Ronnie was also thinking about was the kind of atmosphere that Miss Helen would be in her home, as opposed to a skilled medical facility, which she feel that she would probably be totally lost and uncared for.
Mm-hmm. I remember the first time I went into Valley Glen and saw Miss Helen. You know, she was sitting in a wheelchair and her head was kind of tilted, and she had a stuffed animal that she was holding. And I remember talking to Ranny about her, and it was quite interesting that, you know, although Miss Helen seemed non-communicative to me, I think Ranny really was able to communicate with her, was able to get a clear reading of how she was doing, how she was feeling. And, you know, it was just quite remarkable to see the level of understanding and the relationship between a seemingly person who wasn't responding with someone who really was, knew them well, spent a lot of time with them, and was able to read their signals. And it's quite, I'm quite certain that, you know, you could never get that kind of fit and that kind of care in a setting where people are doing shift work, where you have different people coming in just for 5-10 minutes at a time. In this setting, you know, you have a living room, you have people sitting around all together, you have the kitchen right next door, you have Ronnie who's there watching all the time. You know, very much more like a home or like a family rather than sort of the more regimented, structured ways in which, for example, people are taken care of in a hospital, let's say, or a nursing home.
Yeah.
And also Ms. Helen was not disruptive.
Exactly.
She was a somewhat complacent resident. And I think that also helped her personality, helped to keep her in Ronnie's home.
And let me just say, too, that over time in Valley Glen, there was a time when Ronnie did accept a resident who was very mobile, was much more active, required much more of her attention, to monitor and keep track of in terms of wandering and the like, and that disrupted the entire environment. So again, in some of these small settings, a change in a person, a change in a resident can be very disruptive to the setting. So that's another one of those, you know, factors to keep in mind, that these settings can change quite dramatically. And often in a smaller setting, you know, if one resident out of five changes, that's, you know, 20% of your population.
Yeah.
With startling effects.
Now, does the state have regulations about the range of a person's abilities and disabilities in terms of who may reside in an assisted living residence?
Yes, they do. Yes, they do. That in Maryland, there are three levels of care, 1, 2, and 3. Most assisted living are approved at level 3, which is a level of care that does not approximate a nursing home. For example, there's certain things that certain kinds of residents you simply wouldn't be able to take, but you can take people who are on the lighter side of nursing home would look like the people living in a nursing home. And the state, you know, does visit, does regulate in the same way that Illinois does, you know, on a regular basis, periodic basis. But again, you know, there's not a one-to-one relationship between regulations and practice. Mm-hmm. And therein lies the dilemma with nursing homes. We have one of the most heavily regulated entities out there, the nursing home, yet there are all kinds of things that go wrong in nursing homes. So regulation is not the answer necessarily to quality care, certainly quality of life.
Yeah. Well, if I had been Miss Helen's daughter, Alicia, I would be very pleased to have her at Valley Glen.
And she was.
At the same time, I wonder if Ronnie, if she could have found herself in hot water.
You know, I don't think so. Mm. Well, who knows? In the time we were there, she wasn't in hot water.
Yeah.
And we know that she had visitors from the entity that regulates assisted living in Maryland. So we knew that took place. So, you know, things were all up and up, and it was a good fit. I think that's what matters in all of this. What matters in all of this is the fit between the resident's needs, wants, and desires and the ability of the place to meet those needs, wants, and desires.
Yeah. And in each story, you see how complex this all is.
It really is.
Yeah. Let's take a call now from a listener in Urbana on line one. Listener on line one, good afternoon.
Hi. Interesting to listen to this. We and my husband's siblings found a place for his mother who had beginning dementia, that was a multi-level care facility. And I'm not sure exactly how you describe assisted living, but she started out very briefly in an independent apartment.
Yes.
But ate at least one meal in a main dining room. Mm-hmm. And we were very pleased before that she was in an assisted living facility in another city. But it was necessary to move her where family could be more accessible, and because she wasn't near any family before that, because her health was deteriorating, and we need to be able to advocate for her with the healthcare professionals. It was very, very helpful that this place had multiple levels of care, because she ended up moving within the facility to a section where there was staff on the floor at night because she started wandering around at night.
Right.
And then she needed to go to a part of the facility that had locked doors so that she couldn't wander away.
Mm-hmm.
And it was very, very helpful for the family not to have to find a new place each time. And,
absolutely.
I would strongly suggest that people think about that possibility and look for those places. It's great if you know where you can take help somebody to move to before it becomes an emergency. And we have an elderly aunt who will be, she's either 101 or 102 now, but her eyesight has deteriorated tremendously, And we convinced her to start to look for assisted living before she had an emergency, where she could be, where she could make the choice of what appealed to her.
Wonderful.
And, well, in that case, we had the warning about her eyesight having deteriorated, and she'd adapted in many ways, but she really was dependent on a couple of friends who were not all that young themselves living nearby. My mom also moved into a multi-level care facility, but isn't starting out in a totally independent apartment, which is great. And one of the things that they, when we were looking at the facility, that they mentioned was that people who move in when they are in reasonably good health and with their faculties form new friendships.
Yes, yes.
Community. And that if their health deteriorates and they need to go even temporarily into the level that need that provides more care, their friends are right there.
Yeah.
My mother-in-law was sure that she'd be leaving all of her friends in Ohio when she moved to Washington, D.C., but her friends weren't visiting her. They were dying or they were becoming unable to move around themselves.
Right.
And so actually, she wasn't leaving people who were able to interact with her. So that's just some things that we learned in our own experience. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call this
Very
afternoon.
Very informative comments.
Yeah. What can you tell us about the transition between living on one's own and moving into a group setting? How long does it take, and what makes for a smooth transition?
Oh, that's a wonderful question. And this is truly one of life's biggest transitions. I mean, the transition out of your own home or apartment into a group living setting for healthcare reasons. That's a huge transition, and it's one that, as Anne said earlier, is often done without a lot of planning and done in a crisis. So, you know, I'd be hard pressed to think of a more stressful, difficult life change. So I think what that says is that, you know, this is a transition that all of us need to spend a lot of time thinking about and addressing. Family members need to think about this. Certainly professionals, policymakers. You know, this is just one of life's big transitions, and there is much, much more we can do. For example, one thing we did in our work was we tried to pay attention to the extent to which the place, the facility itself, spent time in helping the person adjust to the new setting. And as you might guess, there was a lot of variability in that. So, again, I would advise those people who are looking for assisted living to ask the question, you know, how can you help me? And if it's the consumer, him or herself, or the family, how can you help me adjust to this? This is a big deal. This is a big transition, selling of my house, et cetera. I do think that what we're seeing is there are many alternatives emerging out there for people who, as they move from into retirement. For example, active adult communities are developing everywhere, it seems. So, you know, people are making proactive decisions to move from, for example, their family home or the home they raise kids into an age-restricted community. You know, that's sort of an introduction to moving into a setting where more services might need to be provided. But, of course, active adult communities don't provide assisted living and nursing, and that may be a problem in the future. The kind of communities that do that today are continuing care retirement communities, where a person can move into the independent living and they have the knowledge that should they need additional care, it can be provided on the same site, maybe not in their apartment, but at least on the same site. So I think those kinds of decisions help mitigate the stress and strain of these transitions.
I would say that most of the adjustment time that we found among residents is probably around maybe 3 months.
Mm-hmm.
There
mm-hmm.
are some people that will never adjust, but I think they're very few, and some people adjust immediately. Maybe they were more involved in the immediate decision of moving in, and they've selected the place.
Yes.
And what we were very impressed with, too, was the administrators who would say, like, you know, who is excited about leaving their home of 50 or 60 years and moving into one room with a bath?
Yeah.
And very understanding of that and going out of their way to help residents, what we call settling in.
Yeah. You know, as the last call-in person said, and I agree with her, the extent to which a family can work with a loved one in introducing them to this, working with them to find a place, putting as much choice and decision-making in their hands as possible is always better.
Mm.
Always better.
Mm. We've got to wrap up here. I wish we had a little bit more time. But there we'll leave it. I want to thank the two of you very much for talking with me this afternoon. And for our listeners, if this is something that's on your mind, look for this book, Inside Assisted Living, The Search for Home. I think it's an eye-opener. It's hopeful, yet quite realistic, and you'll get an idea of the complexities that are involved in assisted living. And my thanks this afternoon to Kevin Eckert and Anne-Christine Frankowski. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Inside Assisted Living, The Search for Home is published by the Johns Hopkins Press.